Welcome, coaches and fellow split talkers. Thanks for joining us on the Talking Split podcast. I am Rob Calder, the Coach Development Officer at Basketball Victoria. With me, I have the High Performance Coach for the Vic Country Women, Zoe Carr. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Excellent. And we also have Basketball Victoria's self-appointed shooting coach who's occasionally moonlighting as the High Performance Coach for the Vic Country Men, Nathan Cooper-Brown. Welcome.
Thanks for finally addressing me by my real title there, Rob. I think it's been over a year now I've been in the job, and that's the first time I've heard it. So I appreciate it. It's good to be back.
I appreciate you dropping the sir in front of the Nathan Cooper-Brown, but it's good to have you back. Thanks to everyone that's been interacting online over the last couple of weeks. The interaction on social media has been fantastic. Once again, you can get us with the hashtag TalkingSplit on any of the socials, except Snapchat or TikTok, because I don't understand either of those. But any of the other socials, more than happy to jump into. Once again, if you are able to like, share, retweet, rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. You can get any of the coaches using their Twitter handles, and Coops, yours is?
At CoachNCB.
Brilliant. And Zoe, yours is?
At ZoeCar85.
Excellent. And I am at Rob Coulter if you need me. Coops, it's been a while since we've spoken to you. What have you been up to in this, I'll put it in inverted commas, downtime since we got COVID hit?
Yeah, downtime. I tell you what, the blessing for me has been spending time with my wife and our young daughter. So I think I was supposed to be away with some different duties for over a month of out of this three, and so instead to be at home and hear her put words together and walk and run and be sassy is has been a nice bonus.
She's been a common cameo on our Zoom sessions too. She doesn't mind jumping in and, you know, rating the kids and telling them what they need to be doing.
First person that actually likes Zoom sessions, it would appear. But, would they feel the same way about glad you're home, or would they be a little bit like, Bulgaria or wherever it was, maybe?
Yeah, I think my wife maybe not so much, but I think Indigo, I think she's enjoyed it.
Excellent. And obviously a little bit more FIFA time in the downtime as well, which is always
It has. I'm almost at a level where I can take you on, Rob. I'm feeling pretty comfortable at my game at the moment.
The secret is drop down the difficulty level. that's how I've managed to survive all these years. It's in fairly true to form, though. I was playing at Sunderland, and I'll digress a little bit. Obviously, Coops is a big Sunderland fan. Watched the Sunderland until I die, so I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and promote these guys out of League One or whatever it is they in. One, which was great, got promoted and got fired. So if FIFA is not the most realistic game of all time, I don't know what is.
Outstanding. So just keeping to form in exactly how our club operates.
Yep. Any level of success.
Firing the best manager that we've had in a while, got us out of League One. Fantastic.
Brilliant. But we are talking today adaptive shooting. So we had the shooting podcast a couple of weeks ago before Bevo last week, but we've jumped into the adaptive shooting, or adaptive finishing, I suppose, is probably more accurate as to what we're dealing with. It changes a little bit depending on obviously our age group and our ability level of our athletes as well. But adaptive finishing is probably taking a real forefront in coaches' minds over probably the last 5 or 6 years, I think. Like, we've started to experiment and be a little bit more creative and things like that. Obviously, we don't have access to the ridiculously athletic level kids that they have in the States, where the adaptive finishing is not overly required because they literally just jump over someone and dunk it. So we don't tend to have those athletes here, unfortunately. So we've had to find different ways to have our kids finish with, you know, the trees around them, essentially, and still find a way to compete at that level. So what do you guys consider to be adaptive finishing in the first place? Is it anything that's not just a normal layup? Coops, I'll start with you.
I think that's a good place to start. For me, it's really about being able to successfully finish within a contest. And then the adaptability arises from, you know, how do I do that? I think that this is great that we're talking about it, that it is come to the forefront of our minds, and specifically Victoria. And probably a little bit too late. So, this is going to be a good one today.
Yep. So what about you?
For mine, adaptive finishing is an ability to just find the gap. How you can find the gap to make either an attempt or at least make a shot. We have your regular layups. For me, I think a reverse layup sits within the layup category. Outside of that, though, I think it's, yeah, you could count it all as adaptive finishing.
Yep. It's interesting, Coops, you hit on the actual ability to execute it. And the finishing part matters. The ball going in matters.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. But what sort of things would we consider? So I've got a couple written down here. So runner is what I would consider a one-foot finish still. So that can be blow by your defender on the perimeter. A runner is those 1-2 steps into a shot. I'm saying that would be shot anywhere from, you know, probably the under 12 foul line would be roughly my guess in that space. Floaters, which was what I would consider a 2-foot stop. So that those giant killer type layups where the big steps up to try and help, you've got to come to that quick stop and then finish nice and high. What other things would you guys consider in that skills package as well?
Well, I think something there too, Rob, that we can bring into the theme of adaptive finishing is understanding how to play in between the lines of the defense as well as in the contest. So being able to adapt to where I am on the floor and, you know, does that runner when I've got space or come into that quick 2-foot stop before I get into potentially what is a shot blocker that I know I'm probably not going to be able to score over. I think that's also part of this, that it doesn't have to be just when we're going clattering into a crowd or we're in the paint. So I think that's probably important for our coaches to understand as well.
Yeah, I think with the change in mentality that I've found at a defensive end, and I could be wrong, but I'm hearing more often coaches, and I've said it myself, to bigs in particular, you don't need to block the shot, you just need to change it. So now the fundamental layup is, at the older age groups, is kind of gone.
You might get it in the break.
You might get
it in transition, yeah, or something,
exactly.
But you're not getting it any
you
other
get
time.
It out on a break, and that's about it. So now we've got a change in mindset from the D of that they're trying to just change shots. Now we need to make that adaptive finishing a part of the tool bag to be able to actually finish and be successful. Because as you said, it's great to be able to adapt, but if it doesn't score, then it's just, you may as well have just handed them the ball. But for mine, you know, the ability to play off both feet with both hands. So, you know, we talk about the fundamental layup of right, left on the right hand side as you're going up with lift the left knee, all that sort of, or lift your right knee, all those sort of things. For mine, you need to be able to same foot, same hand and elevate. You need to be able to play outside the cylinder. So, what I mean by that is, you know, we teach finger rolls or we teach early days like to actually shoot their layups as a shot. Now taking that outside of the width of your shoulders. So whether it be almost like a hook, whether it be in and under and attack the armpit of the big to try and draw the foul and get to the line as well. Being able to play outside of that cylinder for me is really important for adaptive finishing.
Yeah, I just to piggyback on that, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I just think that's such an important aspect of this to understand that release point and where is the ball in relevance to the defense and all those different areas, almost like a, 280 degree area of being able to finish outside your body. And then something else I think is a big part of that is the ball security. So where is the ball prior to the release point? You know, am I coming through a crowd of low hands trying to strip, or am I kind of taking the ball high, hands are high, do I need to dip back under? So there's kind of that almost three-step to the footwork that Zoe spoke about, the ball's security, and then the release point.
Where do you think the ball's most secure on that? Because I know a lot of players in particular, if they're on the bounce, will probably carry the ball fairly low. Which, and if we watch the NBA at the moment, like James Harden has really mastered that act of get the ball out in front but nice and low and then rip the ball up through defense's arms and with the attempt to get fouled. Does that sit well with you guys in terms of what our junior athletes should be doing?
I'm not a massive fan on seeking contact because I feel like seeking contact is bringing referees into the game a little bit. So you're relying on referees. Disclaimer, not smashing referees here, just saying.
That's a different podcast. That's Talking Split After Hours.
Let's just try and not leave it up to them, is more my point. If you want to be an international level player, it's up to you. So don't be relying on a bailout type call because you've gone and tried to seek this contact. You need to be able to play with contact, but not to me. I don't like watching athletes go and seek it for as they're going for a shot. They're seeking it in the block to try and gain position. That's a totally different thing.
I mean, playing devil's advocate on that, the only thing that I would say in challenge with that, if the player was going to actively seek the contact, they need to be able to get to their shot if they didn't get it. Or if they got the contact, didn't get the call, you still got to be able to get there and finish, rather than what we see a lot potentially on a Friday night. I'm going to go clattering in, kind of flip the ball up, you know, and I don't get the call, I don't. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's that prayer type chuck almost at the end that we see a lot in our junior athletes. And that's what I'm talking about when I say I don't like seeking contact. If you're an elite level player, like, you know, if you are a Harden and you can do that, well, go for it, mate. Like, you get into the line, you're still finishing the bucket. That's great. I think in terms of teaching, though, when we're starting to introduce adaptive finishing to athletes, I think it's about more so trying to play, as I said before, outside of those cylinders. And if we can play it from sort of chest height and above in the beginning, I think that'll go a long way. And then athletes will discover on their own different ways to find different ways to shoot or to finish or to get their shot away as they progress. And as you put them in positions to discover new and different ways.
That's a great point. Probably a good one for talking about some practical takeaways, in that Zoe and myself and our colleagues, we talk a lot about not playing through the strike zone. Something that we stole from the guys up at the COE, and for anyone that, you know, doesn't know baseball, it's, you know, roughly kind of just above the knees to just below the shoulders, but we're really talking about the belly and just kind of rocking and dragging or exposing the ball through that belly area. Is that one that you see more often or not that just gets stripped? And so exactly what Zoe's saying, can I take the ball above that area? Can I keep it high away from those kind of wandering hands? Is a good place to start on basic ball security.
Absolutely. And you look at some of the pros that have used this. Ginobili really revolutionized the Euro step. Like, it's, I'd never seen it, I know personally, before I saw him doing it, and then it was almost like he's traveling. Like, that's crap. It's like, actually, Pop wouldn't allow that to happen. He's probably not traveling. He's probably doing something pretty cool. But it's amazing how often, like, we could go and watch a game on a Friday night now, and we see under 12 athletes, like, Euro stepping on a finish. And it's like, damn, like, this is fantastic to see kids doing this, because they're not only executing a skill, which is great, and look, in fairness, when an under 12 kid just makes a layup, everyone's just happy at the best of times. But when they actually make a decision to execute a Euro step to get to that layup, that is phenomenal, because that has shown being able to read what's going on in front of you, then actually execute what's going on past that. That is huge. So, I mean, Ginobili is one of the best. There's no question. Like, it's, you know, but that whole era of players, like, I've got written down, like, Ginobili, the Dirk step back, like, is iconic. Like, everyone has seen that thing, you know, for years, essentially. The Nash ability to finish outside his body. Like, and that is a midget Canadian. That is, like, he's not rolling through there at 6'6 or anything like that. He is a small Canadian that could finish against massive units in there. The Kobe pivots in general. Like, his ability to try and find ways to twist and turn and shoot off balance shots but still make them, like, was 100% phenomenal. Everyone's favourite point guard, Campazzo. I've even said it with a little bit of a twang on
that. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, like, if nothing else, Ash's ears have pricked up somewhere and he's like, someone said Campazzo. That's what's going on there. But his ability, again, as a small guard who doesn't look overly quick by any means, but his ability to finish outside his body and in the traffic that goes on in that Spanish league is phenomenal. Then you got the Olajuwons, like the dudes that were just phenomenal at reading what was going on in front of them, shot fake, up fake, pass fake, up, under, pivot, spin, like those sorts of guys. So the adaptive finishing isn't necessarily just a layup. Like, it's all realm of a player's arsenal, which is huge to work on.
Yeah, I think, you know, if I want to be that coach for a second and say from the women's game point of view, We've got Snelly, Belinda Snell, who's coaching Frankston's NBL1 at the moment, or once that's back up. The step back and her release and her ability to shoot the ball from the perimeter with off all kinds of dribble penetration or all kinds of, you know, step backs, whatever she's doing, was just incredible. And the ability to then hit. You've got Diana Taurasi, who just wants to score and nothing will stop her scoring. She gets in there, you hit her, she falls sideways, she shoots outside of her cylinder and it goes in. Like, just constant connection with the rim, connection with the target, an absolute willingness of, I am scoring this, I really don't care what you guys are going to do.
Well, and when was the last time she got a clean look at anything?
Never.
Like, I mean, that's the reality, but she's so incredibly talented that she is overplayed on everything.
Yep.
Like, everything she catches, she has to be off balance or falling out of court or with two defenders draped all over it and still manages to find a way.
Yeah, and you look at a Penny Taylor as well, you know, in her absolute prime. The only way to stop her, because she was too big in her day, she was too big for the guards and she was too small for the bigs, for the bigs. So they would always be constantly bringing a big across from split line or from wherever to come and try and double team her as soon as she put the ball to the floor in penetration. Her ability to navigate that and then again get outside her cylinder and finish, or attack the armpit and finish, was incredible. But again, I also think a lot, we talk about adaptive finishing and we always talk about from the shoulders up, but I also think the footwork is just as, if not more important. How are you actually getting into those gaps? A lot of the time we see athletes, especially junior athletes, they'll see the gap, which is great, because that's the hardest part, I think, to teach, is what to see. But they'll see the gap, and instead of trying to maneuver themselves with footwork, whatever footwork that might be, they'll try and just sort of squeeze through the gap, shoulders first, and then we get that prayer kind of chuck at the rim. And I think a focus on that footwork, like every single athlete both of us have named, are phenomenal footwork athletes. Their footwork is out of this world. So I think it's something that probably needs to be considered when we talk adaptive finishing.
I think that's a great point. And talking about the footwork and tying that into, you know, when am I taking off? When is my advantage at its, you know, as its greatest? And when thinking about, you know, Campazzo, when thinking about Taurasi, Nash in particular, you know, stealing, that quote I heard from, I think it was Cody Toppett, who does the work with the Phoenix Suns, when in doubt, take a bounce. And their ability to play through that Nash zone, that space behind the backboard, or getting really deep into the lane. And if it's not on, I'm going to take another bounce. I'm going to get out. I'm going to reassess. Or do I play off 2 feet and give myself some pivots to maybe, you know, create more space or find that certain advantage, is a big part of what we're talking about. And then I have to throw this one in there because I'm so proud of myself. You know, if I could do it, I'd be patting myself on the back. But a phrase that I've coined is fast feet to create a split, slow feet to create a decision. So, you know, can we get athletes understand that we're trying to, yeah, use that speed, use that first step to blow by, because we want to get some separation, want to create an advantage, get a split. But then when we start seeing those second and third lines of help, let's slow down. Let's start, you know, trying to assess the data and make the best decision possible.
Well, first person I hear use that at a training session now, I'm going to have them pay you a dollar. Like, this is the price of copyright.
Royalties. Yeah. What do you think, I guess, is more, do you find one more important than the other, or do you think they're, you know, it's an all round all the same, or where would you even start? Would you start with footwork, or would you start with?
No, I wouldn't. I'd actually start with the upper body. So yep. Like the hand positions and things like that. I think footwork can come down the road, but the ability to put the ball on the ring or on the backboard where you need to put it to actually make a shot cannot be undersold. And I certainly know, like, growing up in the backyard with a basketball ring and things like that, I was one of the fortunate ones that had a ring up with no backboard for a while there, and then I had the backboard up, and, you know, there were holes in the backboard. But what it did teach me was where I had to put the ball on the backboard or on the ring to drop the ball in. So you get to have some fun with, can I throw it off the backboard with, like, spinning my hand, and, like, you're practicing, like, your Shane Warne leggies and things like that, trying to get it off at the right angle and things like that. Like, that was actually kind of the cool stuff. But I could do that if I had a busted ankle or whatever the deal was. It just gave me a different understanding of not every finish is the same.
Yeah.
Like, and it didn't matter which foot I was jumping off. I had a dodgy ankle or something like that. It was simple that, well, I can still shoot it with my right foot. And that was how I got balance, and I understood it a little bit that way. But that's something probably our kids don't do a great deal of at the moment, is just go and sit with a ring for a little while and just spend 20 minutes. It doesn't have to be form shooting. Like, it's...
play horse.
Be. Yeah, but that kind of stuff. Like, have some fun with it and, like, jump off the wrong foot. Like, try and get it off the very top corner of the backboard, and where do I need to put it so that it can drop in? Like, have some fun with this stuff, because it is actually fun.
Well, and that's where probably I'm going to be a bit controversial and disagree with you.
Fine.
I think the footwork should come first, mainly because of the age group that we're teaching, and we start to introduce adaptive finishing. You know, you're saying under 12s are doing Euro steps and finishing, which is fantastic. If we don't have the footwork and the leg strength to be able to power that up because we're using a ball that's too big, which seems to rate a mention in every pod.
I'm hoping if it gets set enough that we'll eventually change to a size 5 basketball.
But in all seriousness though, we can't rely on upper body alone. And I feel like if we're able to introduce that footwork, different types, and as you said, same foot, same hand, you know, Euro steps, floaters, whatever it might be, if we start introducing that strength and that ability to move and adapt with our feet, then that will help us have the power to actually be successful with the upper body.
All right, Coops, you're going to pick one.
Wait for him.
He'll go full Switzerland here. Jeez, I think you're both right.
Get out of my brain, because that's exactly what I was going to do.
That's fine, Coops.
For me, excuse me. For me, I mean, these are the Kyrie Irving stories. Excuse me. Yeah. That this is exactly what he was doing and still does. There's footage on YouTube of him warming up before NBA games, and it is literally a version of mic and drill, or just one or two step footwork with variety finishes, combining those two things that you guys just spoke about, you know, getting the strength, getting the different feel off his feet, using different, you know, high hooks and spins and reverses, because he knows, you know, what, 6'1", you know, great at creating a split, but he knows when he gets in there, it's got to be something funky. And it's not just exploring and feeling the moment. He knows he's got to practice it. And I think that's a good one for hopefully some of the athletes that might be tuning in, is get out there and be doing those things on a regular basis.
Yeah, well, I mean, playing the game horse, and if you're not sure what the game horse is, please contact us. It's an absolute ripper. But playing that game basically taught adaptive finishing in a fun, unaware, like, you weren't aware of what you were learning while you were playing it, especially if you got somebody who, like you said, spins the ball off the backboard and you've never seen that before, and now all of a sudden I've got to try and do that. Now, the competitor in me would clunk it the first time, so of course would go away, would practice it, so next time I played that person again, I'd be able to get it right and potentially win. So those sort of things, though, are, I think, vital. That we talk about pickup, we talk about playing older athletes and things like that, but even just little, what we consider silly little games, there is still a lot to get out of that.
I think that's really, I mean, I was a taller kid in my age group, but I was what the Australian Institute of Sport would probably refer to as an unco. So consequently, didn't have a career in basketball, but I did have friends that were older than me. So consequently, I sort of moved in those circles a little bit more, played pickup at school and things like that with older and stronger and things like that. But it did teach me I can't do what I'd normally do in my normal age group to be successful here. Like, I'm going to suck at this because they're going to move me off the block. And if that's where I got my catch, it certainly wasn't where I was shooting it from. Or if I ripped down a rebound, and let's face it, I didn't rip down anything. But if I happened to be in the right spot where the ball would fall into my hands in a rebounding contest, I couldn't just go up with outside hand because that thing would be sent into the back fence pretty quick. So it does teach. Like, I'm a big believer in pickup basketball. Like, the more our kids could play pickup, I think the better they would be. Because they just have to trial and error, and they don't have to worry about, oh, what's the coach going to say? What are my parents going to say if I butcher this completely?
Yeah, story time, Rob.
Ooh.
We're back.
It's a perfect segue into an experience I had when I was, I would say, training fodder for the Victoria Titans in the NBL.
Just explain who the Victoria Titans are for those that probably don't have
for
a recollection of that.
Post 1990.
Yeah, exactly. In the 90s. Wow, starting to show my age now. Yeah, so I think Melbourne United a long, long time ago, everybody.
Gotcha.
For us, it was at the end of every practice, we were getting, you know, 3, 4, 5 guys, and it was 2-dribble 1-on-1. And it was a really competitive thing that, you know, we wanted to get these, you know, pick on people and say, hey, you know, I want to beat you today. Like, let's get after it. But it was a conscious decision of playing against, you know, really good athletes with a finite number of dribbles because that was going to get us better. And so, you know, I was playing on Dave Barlow, you know, who's 6'9" and about, you know, 50 kilograms heavier than me. I've got to come up with something different. Then the next guy is Mark Dickell, you know, who used to point guard for New Zealand. So, you know, quick, you know, I've got to come up with something different. Then it's Brad Sheridan, you know, go gadget arm. So it was, you know, every single possession, literally trying to come up with a variety of ways to score. And you just don't see that happening as much anymore. And I would, I just can't recommend to coaches and to athletes is to find those ways, exactly what Rob's talking about, pick up extra one-on-one, just those sorts of opportunities to get better.
I think a really important part of encouraging our athletes to go and play pickup and play these things and explore and discover new ways and really jump into adaptive finishing is when they transfer it into your game in terms of whether it be Friday night or domestic or a state team or whatever that is. We've got to then champion that whether it works or not in the game, and even if it costs us a game, you'll walk out, heart will be broken because the euro hasn't come off, or we've jumped same foot, same hand, and it hasn't worked. But at the end of the day, like everything, we need to be consistent in our messaging. And if we've encouraged them to go and do those things and find out these new and exciting ways to score the ball, then we have to sit beside them and be okay when it doesn't work, because I think in the throes of the game, we can get caught up and forget what is really important and what messages we are sending to those athletes.
Yeah, I got to second that. Like, it's such an important point because I feel like the game for us right now is at a real segue, almost like a crossroads of this gritty, kind of traditional way of playing basketball that Australia's been really proud of and built on. And we're now starting to find the European and a little bit more of the American, you know, kind of the funky ways of being able to play the game, that little bit more flair and adaptability and all those sorts of things. And Zoe's right on the money, is that we've got to champion that as coaches. We've got to make sure that we're supporting the process, is that if they try it in games, hey, great. Yeah, you didn't work on it. You know, and then after that, from a coaching standpoint, just reconnect with the athlete. Hey, that spin, wide hook, high glass one that you missed. Hey, love that move. It was the right decision at the moment. Make sure you start practicing that, you know, on a regular basis so that it, you know, we start making it more often than not.
And you're spot on there too. Adaptive finishing is no different in a game to say if you're coaching and you throw a box and one on your team and you've never drilled it and then expecting them to be amazing at it. We've got to put them in positions in practice in decision-making drills, in small-sided games, whatever it might be, for them to be able to practice it. That way, once it comes to the game, and, you know, I've always been a big believer of confidence comes from the work, it doesn't come from the coach, they get into the game and now here comes this brilliant opportunity to Euro or to spin and outside hook. And I've done this already before, potentially even on this court. I know how to make that shot now. And the confidence is there and you're more likely to succeed. But if we don't put them in those positions at our practices, we can't expect them to then be successful at it.
All right. So I'll ask you both. At what age would you start teaching adaptive finishing? Because there's obviously a fundamental layer we have to teach them. Mm-hmm. They need to have the correct footwork and the correct hand and all that sort of stuff. At what point would you start throwing in a Euro, a floater, a runner, a spin, a step back? Like, can you put it in straight away? Is this something you wait for them to sort of seek you out about? Like, where is the tipping point for that?
For me, it's under 12s, but there's obviously some decisions around what and how often at that age group. I think at under 10s, you're still working on your traditional outside inside, you know, forehead layup, because you're getting a lot more of those on a break, you know, the game, you know, when that game kind of opens up, or even if you do get into the traffic, it's a lot more black and white in getting an uncontested layup, or probably an uncoordinated, you know, 9-year-old falling into the shooter. But I think by under 12s, particularly to VJBL level, you're talking about championship, you know, there's those times when the runner is the right decision. You know, there's three defenders in front of you, but you created a really good split. You've got room, you've got time, you know, your eyes are up. That, you know, that can be a high percentage shot if we're working on it in our practices. And then obviously as we move up, we start spending more time and we start getting more creative and have a little bit more fun with it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think eights and tens, you're just working on the traditional fundamentals of footwork and shooting the ball. Under 12s, I think that's when you start to introduce the Euros, the floaters, reverse layups. And then probably around under 14s is where you start and get really funky with it. You know, same foot, same hands, spins, all those sort of things, where it also keeps it fun and enjoyable for them too, because it's the next level up. Like if you're talking, like Rob, you made a comment on one of the earlier pods about making games like Fortnite or making games like video games, you know, so we want to make sure we're continuing to level up the athletes. So it's getting gradually harder. Everything is just outside their skill set. So they've got something to work towards. So then once they achieve it, they get that sense of achievement. And then here comes the next level.
Yeah, that's I like that. It makes me think there's Michael Cassidy, who's obviously assistant coach up with the Sailormen. He's doing a lot of breakdown work at the moment from the Boomers, particularly at the last World Cup. And the amount of contested shots compared to uncontested is, you know, off the charts, in more than you would imagine. And I'm look forward to getting his data and us being able to share and talk about it. But that'll, you know, have some hard numbers to show the coaches that obviously the higher we're getting, the likelihood of the uncontested is just minimalized. And I think the other thing too, when we're talking about, even if, you know, we're starting under 12s, 14s, whatever it may be, and this is that old chestnut where we talk about all the time, is the why. And I remember, you know, Coburg Giants, under 14s.
And you were just dropping a whole bunch of clubs in this podcast.
I know, right? This is like talking to Wally. Hey? Coburg Giants.
been everywhere. People realize once I've been there for about 6 months, they didn't really want me anymore, so I had to move on. But it was, you know, a Cincinnati or a three-man weave, whatever it may be. And then we're into, like, let's say what we thought back then was an adaptive finish, like a reverse layup, but there was no why. And there was no situation where, you know, we were going to go shot blockers on our back. I want to use the rim to protect the ball. We didn't get that information. So I think that's also on us as coaches is we're doing adaptive finishing and this is the why.
Coops, you've experienced the World Championships with the 17 men previously. What sort of stuff are we seeing there when we look at adaptive finishing? What are we seeing and why are they consequently needing it when they get to that level?
Yeah, it's a great question, and something that I try and get out to my CV men so often is the complete different in game play, especially around the physicality. So what I mean by that is, you know, particularly on a Friday night, create a split, you know, go driving into a crowd, you know, throw that prayer up that Zoe's talking about. And look, more times than not, you're usually ending up at the free throw line. Mum and dad, everybody's clapping because you got to the free throw line. You know, we think that's a good possession. Under 17 and above, I mean, we're talking FIBA international basketball, is so unbelievably physical, like more than players really can imagine. And those habits quickly get found out. And so, you know, guys go driving in, kind of throw their body up into defenders. And if that defender has any sort of position, it's a no call. And so straight away, you've got to work out playing off 2 feet becomes a huge, huge aspect to your toolbox in terms of playing lower and wider, having some strength, potentially getting into a position where you don't have the original shot, being able to create something else. That's a big one. Being able to play at 2 speeds. Am I attacking that big slowly and I get them to bite and then it's a quick second or third step or an extra dribble? So it's those kind of nuances that are so important at that level, because the physicality is just so great. You are not getting to the free throw line as much.
So did that, and don't throw anyone under the bus here, not that I think you would, but either way, did any of the athletes struggle with that when they went there the first time? Because it's something they hadn't experienced before. And yep. What did you do to help them through that once they got there?
Yeah, everybody did.
Yep.
Everybody did. It really was a major concern. And the biggest thing for us was film. It was showing these guys what it looked like when they went kind of clattering in, and what did the defense look like in front of them, what potentially was another avenue to score, and had they done a job in collapsing the defense enough that it needed to be kicked out. So it was that visual learning of, you know, what did it look like, what were some other options. But yeah, I mean, it was something we definitely had to work through with most of the athletes.
Yep. What about the state level?
State level, wow. We saw a lot at the last 16s in Darwin. Saw a lot of feet in the paint, sort of head down, butt up, and that throwing up the prayer, unfortunately. And again, weren't getting to the line as often as they would be on, say, a Friday night or in domestic competition. So the successful teams, from what I witnessed, did a great job of evolving that over the week and finding different ways to score. So really exposing, I know the country women in particular at their shootarounds just went right back to their split kick extra fundamentals and principles of play. So great job. You've got into the paint. Now you're in the jungle. Now kick. And whether the extra goes or the shot goes, whatever that might be. But that then drew everyone out of the paint for them to then on that after the extra make that next penetration. And it wasn't quite as, I guess, cluttered, or, you know, there weren't as many people in the paint. Wasn't as much from the women's side, wasn't as much adaptive finishing in terms of, you know, anything different that we wouldn't normally see. So there were Euro steps. There were, on the women's side, there's more runners than floaters. They tend to not want to play outside of their cylinder because outside of their cylinder is not safe. Unfortunately, neither is inside it. So you're probably better off getting outside the cylinder. So the ones that were quite successful did seem to make that adjustment throughout the week and change from your normal, what would I say, regular style of play into that heading down the track towards what Coops is talking about.
So how much do we need to teach this? And this is the, do we need to show our athletes what a Euro step is if they don't know it? Or is it something that we actually need them to self-discover a little bit without us really steering them down the path? Because there's an element where, look, we can spend all the time we want teaching it, but until they know really when to use it, how to use it, why they're using it, they're probably not going to do it anyway. So how much do we have to lead them down the path versus how much do we just leave them to their own devices with this?
I think, from the first part of that and the more research I've been doing around this, for me, like let's say if we're talking about a 60-minute session, for me, 75% of that session, so at least 45 minutes, should have finishing, like a lot of finishing. And obviously, you'll have some different things within that that you're working on it, but should have a high finishing rate attached to it. And then if I was coaching an under-16 VJBL team, I'd probably have around the same percentage because I can't think I could count on one hand that, you know, there's those times on a VJBL that we didn't say, oh, gee, what a good game, but we just didn't make shots. Mm-hmm. You know, or we made so many good moves, the ball just didn't go in. Well, that's on us. Mm. Like, we've got to be working on this more and more and more. And so I think that's the first place to start. What was the second part of the question, Rob? Sorry. So it was how much are we teaching it?
Yeah, versus how much self-discovery. Like how much do we just leave them to their own devices to work it out?
Yeah, something I've been experimenting with our men is working more in 15-minute blocks now. So let's say a game, 60-minute session. So cutting that into four blocks. So not trying to force kind of too much into the session. And really working that first 5 minutes or whatever we're doing as the self-discovery part. And Zoe and I have been talking about this a lot, and I really stole a lot of this of her courage to start having the athletes play a little bit more and do more of that discovery. So we maybe would do some maybe 1v2 or whatever it may be, and there's no instruction. It's like, go out, you work it out, have some fun, you may come up with something. And then it's either through my own notes around something we have identified that we need to work on, like a Euro or a spin or whatever, or we may watch that 5 minutes and say, hey, well, we're playing a lot of 2 feet now. We've kind of got half of it, but we're missing the other half in the next 5 minutes where we have budgeted for kind of working on it, you know, maybe on zero or further instruction. That's what we're going to go work on. And it might be only 2.5 minutes out of the five. So we go 5 minutes of discovery. We're just playing. We're having some fun. We're working it out. Okay, guys, stop. Now we're on zero, you know, 2.5 minutes. Oh, yeah. Well, it's this footwork plus this finish. And then the assistant coaches and I look at it and say, yep, all right, we're back in a good space. Let's bring the defense back and go. So that's kind of where I'm at in experimenting on maybe a possible best practice. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the discovery comes from your teaching. So exactly what Coops is saying there. As coaches, we need to, and it took me a long time to get comfortable with this, but we need to put them in positions to allow them to discover and understand that that is us teaching. We don't always have to be talking to be teaching. So again, I'll give you an example. We were at Traralgon. I was at Traralgon for one of the sessions. We were doing a drill that was basically 1-on-2. The on-ball defender was at a disadvantage and they had to make decisions on how to finish. Now, one of the athletes steps up and their first step is almost sideways and defense was getting back into it too easily, you know, as quick as they could. I could have at that stage said, stop. You need to step forward on your first step and get there. But instead, we waited for his next turn. The next one, the step was better, but it wasn't quite there. Again, could have jumped in, but there's been an adjustment, so let it go. And then third one, bang, at the rim, great finish, you know, and that's where we're at. Where I then come in is, what was different between that and your last two? To make sure they know that they'd gone through that process. And that's me teaching by drawing that information out. So I think by putting them in those positions to be able to discover, we need to understand that is still a form of us teaching.
Well, and the studies show too, like something that the players self-discover is more likely to turn up in a game than something we've had to physically impose on them. It's like, no, you need to do this, this, and this. it doesn't mean like we're the same people that's telling to get in stance on defense or close out the ball better or to kick the ball ahead. It just loses a bit of meaning.
Yeah.
Whereas if we can have them self-discover it, there is a far greater likelihood of that being replicated in a game situation when put under pressure. So the more we can lead them down that path, the better it's going to be. Touch. Well, it's something we've spoken about a little bit, but how do you teach touch in players? Because there are some kids that regardless of how much you work with them, when they shoot the ball, that thing comes out like a cannon and there is no chance of it going in whatsoever. And bigs in particular are the ones that probably need to worry about this the most, because if they do come down with a rebound and they have a big sitting on their hip straight away, how are they able to go and finish that without throwing it to the bottom of the ring and dealing with contact? How do you go about teaching touch in particular to post players? Zoe, we might start with you on this, given you're the undersized four that probably had to deal with this the most.
Yeah. Well, I threw up fakes and drop steps, so there was nobody near me. That's how I did it. But
clean house.
Yeah, clean house with a few bows. No, I don't recommend that. One of the drills I think I stole it from someone, but I can't remember where, so I can't give them credit. But we have – it looks like a silly drill. It looks like a bit of a time-waster drill. But basically, you have two athletes facing each other with their hands slightly forward and their fingertips touching. And you have an athlete in the middle of that, and they have to shoot through those hands and finish off the glass. Sounds really easy, but – after a few goes of doing that, you're absolutely exhausted. But the understanding of break the hands and you might have to hold onto the ball for a little longer to get through that contact to then finish, or you might use – like a lot of them will try and use that momentum to get through and throw it, and the hands just being there deflected off into different directions. And I found that to be really successful with post players in terms of and also – developing hand strength, because they need to be able to hold onto that through the jungle. So I'll try and we've got a session tomorrow. I'll try and video it and throw it up on Twitter. But yeah, I've found that to be really helpful in terms of understanding, okay, so I don't just catch it and throw it. I've got to catch it. I've got to sight my target. I've got to break through the contact, and then I've got to make sure I finish it off.
Yep. Coops, what have you used?
Yeah, I think that's a really good one. I've used that one before when working with some bigs. When I was out in Ballarat, Joy Burke, we had some similar things. We'd just get some weight on her arms or kind of get her off balance, and that feel of, you know, my body's going a different way or my arm comes off the shot a little bit earlier as some really good ways of working to build that touch. I think something just to remember, which is always a good cue, is we shoot layups with our eyes. And there's that ability as a coach, you know, when we're working on some sort of finishing aspect, is to position yourself underneath the basket on the baseline and really focus on the athlete's eyes, you know, as they come through and here comes the contact, do their eyes, you know, leave the target to the floor. Obviously that's an intervention cue right there. That's always a good one. I think the other thing too about touch is it's similar to shooting, as I've gone further, you know, through my coaching journey, realizing that so much of basketball is such a personal thing, and you know how somebody does, you know, shoots, you know, the next person is going to be different, and we don't need to uniform everybody. Ash and I were, before the lockdown, were getting some shots, and you know, we were talking about shooting and so on, and he shoots his kind of floater runner kind of out the heel of his hand. And you've seen, you know, a lot of players do that where they kind of shoot that knuckleball. They don't get the rotation and they're able to get some touch from that part of their hand. I can't replicate that. For me, it comes off my fingertips, you know, kind of like a jump shot. So I think there's room again in that self-discovery to help the athletes experiment and work out what works for them and finding different ways of doing it that'll help them be successful and not necessarily uniforming it.
Do you think some athletes just have it?
Yeah, no question. Like there are some kids, like it's, you see the little three-year-old kids that pick up a golf club and just the swing looks immaculate and it's like, man, that's not taught. Like that, some people obviously have a bit of a knack for it, but it doesn't mean it can't be taught or can't be learned either. Like there's absolutely ways. Like it's, I can't shoot a runner or a floater to save my life. and I don't know what it is. Like, it's, I've literally looked at it through film and I cannot work out why I can't do it, because, and I'm similar to you, Coops. I'm off the fingertips because that's where I feel like I have a little bit more control. But I don't know if it's because of where I'm aiming, as in, should I be going off the glass on this? Am I aiming at the back of the rim where I would usually aim at for a jump shot as well? So there is, and look, granted, I don't practice this a lot, it'd be fair to say. I've moved on from that part of my life, but it can be taught and it can be learned as well. It's just, can it be taught and learned at a point where it can appear in a game? And that's really what matters. And I think there's room still to teach one-on-zero stuff, because I think there does have to be a feel about it. Like, okay, and I've put my foot there and I put my foot there and that's how I change direction. And that's where, like, I think there is still a lot of merit in getting the feel for it. But once they've got it, you almost need to guide them in with dummy defense a little bit. It's like, well, okay, once you've got the feel of it, here's roughly where the defense would be. So now here's where you need to move the ball or windscreen wiper it to get it to where it needs to get to. So, and then it's like, right now we're on one-on-one, go work it out, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think, like, for me, I was always a post player, and inside the paint, everything was off the glass except for my hooky to the middle. That was always only rim. My, like, turn and face and shot from the block was always rim, when we're always normally taught backboard. But one of the things that Phil Brown said to me, and it stuck with me like glue, is, I don't care what you do, but that is what you do every time. Because the last thing you want to do is be searching for your target, because do you go backboard, do you go rim, backboard, rim, oh, the shot's gone. And then it hits that little connector in the middle and flies off and you don't have a chance. So he's like, pick now and now stick with it. And that's what I did. Every block shot from the block was all rim. Every hooky was all rim. Everything else was off the glass inside the paint. And I found that to be helpful for me, because I knew what target that I was looking for each time, and it gave me a better chance of then hitting it.
Do you have a preference, Coops, in particular inside the paint, whether you want kids finishing off the glass or whether you want them going rim?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's about arc. Yep. And so whether it's rim or backboard is, again, I think it's up to them and potentially scenario-based, but I don't think there's enough conversation and work with us around understanding of the arc of that shot and how to utilize, you know, I mean, Steph Curry's a great one to obviously go and watch, you know, a guy that developed, you know, that kind of bring rain teardrop shot. And for me, it's like, that's almost your get out of jail free card, is that if you understand how to give it that little bit extra, like, you're going to be a lot safer. And yeah, just in my experience, probably not enough discussion with athletes about how to use that it's always been corner of the square. Or, you know, kind of back of rim, you know, so that, yeah, there's probably room there for coaches to start exploring ways in which to develop the arc of that layup or that floater, that runner around the rim.
It's a bit situational. Imagine a kid catches the ball on the wing, rips the ball through to the middle of the court, driving down the middle. Do you want them using backboard on that layup over the front of the rim? Or do you want them just being able to have that touch over the front of the rim? Because that is a little bit of not everyone has the same opinion on this. Like, it's obviously when you're coming in at a 45, life is grand. You're using the backboard. Mm. But do you want them using backboard if they're going down Main Street in the middle?
I don't. I'm probably, again, probably different to everybody else. I don't. I find coming down Main Street and going over the rim to find your target, especially for young athletes, you know, you're under 12s and things who – the rim is so far away anyway, to then have to go over that and see over that to see their target, I think is difficult. The touch over the front of the rim, I think especially for boys and men's basketball, is important, because eventually that should lead to a dunk.
Yeah. I mean, that athleticism of you know, getting to a dunking spot is something that would be nice if we had more athletes to work with. But I think, and again, probably more so on the men's side of the thing, is understanding your goaltending. Is it, you know, how quickly can I either get the ball coming down or obviously get it on the backboard? Because then, you know, then I've got the goaltending rule to help me as well, rather than kind of leaving the ball up there to potentially get blocked. So I think that's something else to consider, particularly for those older athletes.
Yep.
So when we're teaching adaptive finishing, what are the best drills we've used? I'm obviously a massive fan of disadvantage drills, like 2-on-1, 3-on-2, 4-on-3. I find that's the best way to teach adaptive finishing. What are the best stuff that you guys have used so far?
For mine, for introducing athletes to adaptive finishing, is simply standing them in front of or about the charge circle distance or under 12 free throw line distance. They have their basketball. An instruction is yelled, whether it be, you know, right, inside, inside, which would mean they have to go to their right side of their body with their inside foot and shoot with their inside hand. And then, so it's just one step and finish, similar to how you break down original layups from the block or fundamental layups from the block, and just, you know, right outside, outside, left inside, outside, and just all different type of finishes like that in terms of introducing them to it. And then obviously once we start to build that and start to put it into gameplay, I'm with you. I love disadvantage or advantage disadvantage. So you have an advantage, but it's only for a very short amount of time. So you've got to figure out how to get this score, because if you don't do it quickly, someone else is coming to send it out of the stadium.
Yeah, yeah, same. I mean, any of those disadvantage kind of build-ups, I think even, you know, you can do some 1v1 constraint stuff. There was a build-up I've used in the past where we would go 1v1 at the dunk spot, no dribble. 1v1 at about under 12 or free throw line with one dribble, and then two dribble from the top of the key. So again, it's not so much about constraining the dribbles. I know Chris Oliver talks about, you know, because we've just said, when in doubt, take a bounce. And so if I'm taking that away, obviously we have conflicting messages, but it's really more about how can I get to my finish quicker. So I think that's probably just something to clarify with coaches. The other one I've enjoyed too, you know, CP3 start. And for the coaches that don't know, that's ball on the back of the defender who's facing the rim. We take the ball off and we're live. Obviously taking that from a 1v1 to a 1v2. So can I maximize my advantage at the 1v1? And then obviously I'm reading the help and going into my adaptive finish. And then with that one, I've started putting some other stationary defenders in, like especially at the nail. So nail defend, almost like octopus from primary school, like feet are planted, but they are able to have that active hand to come digging in. And so all of a sudden, again, that ball security, you know, now has to change, or my driving angle has to change. And just, again, you know, providing more data for the guys to have to calculate on their way to the rim.
You've done well, Coos. We've gone 58 minutes and you've dropped your first data. it took some time, but we got you there in the end. You've done well. I think that pretty much wraps us up for all the adaptive shooting. Like, hopefully that does help some of our coaches out there. If we didn't name you or the club you play at, keep listening, because we probably will over the next couple of weeks. We've dropped some serious names in this podcast. We will get to you at some point with our question, but hopefully that does give a little bit of assistance to those. I mean, shooting's one thing, and it's funny, I was just on a webinar before and someone asked me, what do you prefer, like, what's better to have, better offense or better defense? And it's like, well, I don't know. Like, they're both equally important. But the team with a higher score tends to win. So I'll take offense anytime. As well as it's more fun for the kids.
Mm.
Like, and that's what we're dealing with usually, is junior athletes. So this sort of stuff can actually be a lot of fun for them, where it's not the mundane turn up and we're doing, you know, Tennessee shooting, or we're doing like, you know, three-man weave into a layup at the end. We want them to have a little bit more fun with this sort of stuff. So this can actually encourage them to go outside and practice at home. And that's I think the big thing is they get access to us, no question, as coaches, but they don't get it anywhere near as much access when we're not there. Mm. So go out and practice in your own time. If we can give them something that's actually a little bit fun to do, away they go. Like, that's the good part. They get to go and experiment on their own.
Yep.
Which is a big thing from my end. So hopefully, fingers crossed, we've got kids shooting runners and teardrops and all this sort of stuff when the VJBL finally resumes. And
making.
We'll be,
Making.
Like, sorry, it's not just shooting. Like, anyone can shoot it. I can shoot it. Like, it's making shots is where I usually struggle. So hopefully that's of some assistance to some of our coaches. Big thanks to everyone that's reached out on social media and all those kinds of things over the last couple of weeks. We do appreciate it. If there's anything you want us to talk about, by all means, hit us up with the hashtag Talking Split. If you've got other teaching points or anything like that, by all means, hit us up on the social media. What is starting to get really cool, though, is people are now starting to share more and more videos of stuff they do at training sessions and things like that, in particular because here's the great irony of it all. Usually when VJBL starts back, the first thing we do is we go, damn, I've got to put my offense in because I have to play in 2 or 3 weeks' time and, you know, I'm going to spend all my time doing this. Whereas at the moment, we have no competition to return to just yet. We don't have a date as of recording this that we're returning back to. So all the coaches are now going and working on skill sets of their players, which is a very novel approach. It's I like it. I really like it.
I love it.
The more time we can spend making our athletes better the player is. And then consequently, and this may shock some people, if we have a team of very good players and very well-skilled players, our team's better.
And good decision-makers.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, guys. That sounds like voodoo to me. I can't get on board with that. Yeah, give me a set offense with players that don't know how to play but can listen to me. I'm good.
The dream. It's the dream. But that is cool because what we are seeing now is a lot more decision-making going on at the training sessions because they're working on the skill sets instead, which is fantastic to see. So the more of our coaches that can send that sort of stuff out there, I think is a really good thing. If you want to throw it out there with the hashtag Talking Split, we'll happily retweet it out there to a whole bunch of people as well that can not necessarily get you more followers, but it certainly increase the knowledge base of our coaches out there. So I think that's a really good thing that we can start doing is sort of sharing this around a little bit more and helping each other out as coaches.
Sure.
That's it for me. Thank you both for jumping in. Been fantastic. As
pleasure.
As always. Thanks everyone for listening. Do appreciate it. As always, we'll be back next week. Special guest time again next
Ooh.
Week. We'll see how that one plays out. But we'll join everyone next week. Thank you very much for Talking Split with us and we will see you soon.